Welcome to the program. Suppose you had a passion as a kid, nurtured that passion, believed in it, and even convinced your parents that there might be value in collecting tens of thousands of comic books. Your dad even lets you take over the garage with your comics. At 5 years old, you fell in love with Batman and somehow knew that it might be a part of your future. You keep your focus. You become a lawyer as the only way to get into show business and parlay that to ownership of the rights to turn Batman into a movie. And then, after all that focus, you get to spend a decade trying to convince someone in a position of power in Hollywood to share or even understand your vision. In the process, you create one of the most successful series in the history of movies, and maybe, just maybe, you keep your sanity while all those around you seem to be losing theirs. That's the story of my guest, Michael Uslan. He has been the creator, the creative force, and the executive producer of the Batman series. He's written about his experiences in a new memoir entitled The Boy Who Loved Batman. It is my pleasure to welcome Michael Uslan to this program. Michael, thanks so much for joining us.
Jeff, this is great. I'm really, really happy to be here.
It's great to have you here. You were a comic book geek before we even knew what a comic book geek kind of was.
Yeah, you know, I was a fanboy at a time before comic book conventions, before the internet, when it was the most isolating hobby you could have. I honestly went years without knowing there was a soul out there like me who was so into comic books and so into superheroes. So, yeah, I started early. My mom said I learned to read before I was four from comics. So I got in early and have stuck with it.
You tell the story of getting your mom to take you to this kind of convention, the precursor of Comic-Con, where you went to this sleazebag hotel in New York, and there were a couple of hundred people that were comic book geeks, and you were so shocked to find other people felt the same way.
It was an amazing turning point moment for me. This was the first comic book convention ever held. So I was learning there's all these people who have this passion the way I do that want to know about the history of comics and appreciate it as an art form. And this was where collectively we invented the comic book panel, the comic book auction, and the comic book costume parade. And, you know, now when I go to San Diego Comic-Con and see 150,000 people dressed up in costume, I think, you know, what hath we wrought? But it's really become a wonderful community, where at first it was just living in isolation.
And you understand at core what it is about comic books, and now later graphic novels even, that people find so appealing. What does that draw?
Well, Jeff, I think it's a combination of things. Number one, comic books absolutely are our modern-day mythology. It's contemporary American folklore. I've always contended that the ancient gods of Greece, Rome, and Egypt still exist, only today they wear spandex and capes. And to anyone who's ever doubted me, I always point out that the Greeks called him Hermes, the Romans called him Mercury, and I call him the Flash. So it's still about warriors battling demons and monsters and wizards and ogres, except it's all in modern-day dress based on modern-day times. The other aspect of it is really all about wish fulfillment. It's themes like alienation and acceptance that permeate any society at any time, no matter what the generation. And all of that is incorporated into the pages of comics and graphic novels.
The other part of it is, and the great Stan Lee talks about this, that while the heroes are important in comics, that it's the villains that really make them.
Well, that's certainly the case of any superhero who has gained popularity and longevity. A superhero is only as good as his supervillains, and thus Batman has had the greatest supervillains rogues gallery in history and has had the singular greatest supervillain ever created in comics, the Joker.
You watched the Batman TV series when it first came on back in 1966. You were a young kid, and in seeing how badly that was done, that was really an inspiration for you.
It was a turning point moment again in my life. That cold winter night, I was so excited that Batman was coming on TV. This was the first superhero show since George Reeves' Adventures of Superman, and it was going to be in color. And then I saw the car was cool and the sets were extravagant, but I was horrified that the entire world was now laughing at Batman. That just killed me. And I had my own little young Bruce Wayne vow moment that night. Although, unlike Bruce Wayne, my parents were safe upstairs in the kitchen, I did silently vow that somehow, someday, I would find a way to show the world what the true original Batman from 1939 was like as a creature of the night stalking criminals from the shadows. And it became my ambition, almost my obsession, you might really call it, to find a way to erase three little words from the collective consciousness of the world culture: pow, zap, and wham.
You had this vision early on, as you say, for this kind of serious, kind of more modern, gritty, dark Batman. Talk a little bit about how that vision evolved between 1966 until ultimately you were involved in the screenplay for the first movie.
Well, the credit really has to go to the magnificent creators, the editors, artists, and writers at DC Comics. People like editor Julia Schwartz, writer Denny O'Neill, artist Neil Adams, who in the 1970s returned Batman, turned him away from those campy TV show images to his darker roots. And then people like Steve Englehart and Marshall Rogers, who introduced such a beautifully stylistic approach, a romantic, darkly romantic approach to Batman, to Frank Miller, who in 1986 deconstructed Batman in the pages of his seminal graphic novel, The Dark Knight Returns. So it has been so much the work of the comic book guys that have helped twist and turn the evolution of the Batman character and helped open up worldwide acceptance to that darker, grittier, more adult version of Batman.
Part of what you've always been so fascinated by, you talk about with Batman, is that because he has no inherent superpowers like some of these other characters at the time, that it makes him more human, more relatable.
It's very true. I think in addition to the villains, there's really two points about Batman that ensures his popularity worldwide. One is exactly what you say. He is not Superman or Spider-Man or the Hulk. He is human. Any kid, any reader can easily identify with this character. I always contend that Batman's greatest superpower is his humanity. And so often he uses his brain, his detective skills, his thought processes to beat the bad guys as opposed to simply his fists or the latest technological gadget. And the other aspect of it, his origin story is so utterly primal on a basic level. Watching his parents murdered in front of his eyes as a kid and sacrificing his childhood at that moment to make a commitment that even if he has to march through hell for the rest of his life, he's going to get the guy who did this and get all the bad guys. That's a story that transcends not only borders but cultures, and is one of the reasons I think people gravitate to Batman, and even as they get older, don't let go of the character and his stories.
Beyond Batman, your interest in comics was even larger than that. I think you collected, 30, 40,000 comics at one point.
Well, I got a lot beyond that even, and recently I've donated 45,000 comic books from my collection to Indiana University's Lilly Library, which is its rare book library.
But you kept some back for yourself.
My son insisted that I keep 5,000 comics and never let them go. So I have agreed to do that.
You started doing this at a time when in the culture there were people that said comics would cause juvenile delinquency, that all things bad at the time would come from the world of comics.
Oh, God help you if you were a kid growing up in the 1950s trying to collect comic books. There was a book out at the time called Seduction of the Innocent by a psychiatrist who was speaking at many PTA meetings and garden clubs and had parents and teachers and ministers quite stirred up that he had interviewed 100 juvenile delinquents. They each had told him that they had read a comic book, and therefore he concluded comic books caused juvenile delinquency. And he went on to indicate that boys who read Batman and Robin could become homosexual, girls who read Wonder Woman could become lesbians, and, of course, the most horrifying claim of all, that comic books cause asthma because too many children were staying indoors to read them instead of playing in the fresh air. It was tough.
And you worked a deal out with your mother that she would go along with you having comic books as long as you read other things as well.
Let me state this clearly. She made the deal with me. I had no bargaining position in this whatsoever. She told me if I kept them neat, read books, read magazines, then I could keep my comics, and she was convinced that I would not become a juvenile delinquent, a communist, or even an asthma sufferer. So it worked out well for both of us.
Talk a little bit about how you kept your focus on this and this passion and interest as you went off to college and decided to become a lawyer and decided that you wanted to be involved in show business in some creative way, but you had your plan B in order to do that.
Well, Jeff, you have to understand, I'm a blue-collar kid from New Jersey. My pop was a mason. My mom was a bookkeeper. I didn't have any money to buy my way into Hollywood. I didn't know anyone in Hollywood. I had no relatives in Hollywood. So the question became, when you burn with a passion, when you have a dream, how do you make that dream come true? How do you get there from here? And to me, I quickly learned I needed a few things. Number one, I needed to get up off the couch and make something happen. That any feeling of entitlement was just going to work against me. The world owed me nothing. It would not come to my doorstep. Number two, I had to learn that the only way I could survive the continual slamming of doors in my face was to pick myself up, dust myself off, go back and knock again, and knock again and knock again until my knuckles bled and have a high threshold for frustration. And I had to market myself, and I had to market my ideas. So that was the game plan, and that was the skill set my parents and teachers gave me. And ultimately, that's what got me through the process, jamming my foot in one slightly open door at a time, trying to get ahead, trying to get on the path that would lead me to where I want to go with Batman.
And even after your efforts in the late 70s to get the rights to Batman and taking on a partner in that effort, that was just the very beginning of the process. The focus had to stay for a decade longer.
It's true. When I finally bought the rights to Batman with my partner, Ben Melnicker, who was legendary in the business and ran MGM in its Tiffany days and put together deals for Ben-Hur and Dr. Zhivago in 2001, I was expecting all of Hollywood would line up at my doorstep. They would see the potential for this dark, serious Batman with sequels and animation, merchandising, and it wasn't to be. Everyone told me I was crazy. They slammed the door in my face. I was turned down by every single studio in Hollywood. And thus, from the time I bought the rights to Batman, it took 10 years for us to get that first picture made by the genius Tim Burton.
Talk a little bit about some of the reasons why this was turned down, because it's pretty remarkable, and it really tells a lot about Hollywood.
Well, at that time, Hollywood was convinced that Superman was the only comic book character that could transcend the comic books and be turned into a big feature film. They felt no other character could do that. Number two, it was the generation who grew up in the era as adults of Seduction of the Innocent, and they looked down their nose at comic books as cheap and lurid entertainment for children and had no respect for comic book creators. So that was the atmosphere going in. They also all thought comic books and superheroes were synonymous, which is not true. They thought comic books were a genre that might be hot one summer at a box office and then cold the next, and had to be convinced, and I spent 35 years in the trenches trying to convince them that comic books were not a genre. They were a source of great stories with colorful characters, just like novels and plays were. So a lot of the rejections that I got were, Michael, you're crazy, you can't do serious comic book films. Michael, you're nuts, you can't do dark superheroes. And for God's sake, nobody has ever made a movie based on some old television series. That's never been done. So the doors just kept slamming in my face.
You were even turned down by Columbia because Annie didn't do well.
Yeah, you should have seen the look on my face at that one. And I had just pitched my heart out for the dark and serious Batman. And when he said to me, you know, it won't work because Annie didn't work, I said, are you talking about the redheaded girl who sings Tomorrow? And he says, yeah. I go, well, what does that have to do with Batman? And he said, oh, come on, Michael, they're both out of the funny pages. So again, it was kind of that Seduction of the Innocent approach, just classifying all comics as funny books.
Talk a little bit about getting Tim Burton involved and how that really made this thing happen.
It's amazing in a career to be able to say you've been involved in projects with three geniuses. On that first Batman film, I believe there were two. Tim Burton, who had a vision for what at that time, and we have to set it in the context of the time, was absolutely revolutionary. Nobody had ever done a dark and serious comic book superhero movie before. Nobody had really attempted to get audiences to suspend their disbelief and believe that this guy, Bruce Wayne, could be real, that he could don a bat costume and go out and fight crime. And it was Tim who had the vision as to how to execute that, including making Gotham City the third most important character in the piece from the opening frames, that audiences had to first believe in Gotham City before they could believe seriously in a guy dressed up as Batman. And having the incredible insight, which almost gave me a nervous breakdown initially, when he said he had to have Michael Keaton to play Bruce Wayne because he was an actor who could convince audiences seriously that he was, as Bruce Wayne, so driven and obsessed to the point of being psychotic that he would put on a bat costume without getting unintentional laughs from the audience as other actors might. It was an incredible genius vision of his that was then executed by Anton Furst, my dear friend, production designer, who designed Gotham City, the look of the Batmobile, the whole piece, and who won the Oscar that year for his work. And I'll tell you this, Jeff, I think if you look at any comic book or genre movie since then, you can still see the influence of Tim Burton's imagery and Anton Furst's design work and even Danny Elfman's haunting notes of music. I really think the influence has been huge.
And then, of course, Christopher Nolan would carry that forward.
Genius number three. And he deserves all the credit, all the accolades, should be the first director of the 21st century studied in every film school. What Christopher Nolan has done has been to raise the bar, not just for Batman films, but for all comic book movies. I think for the first time when you walk out of a movie like Batman Begins or The Dark Knight, audiences can say, not just simply, oh, that was a great comic book movie. They can say, that was a great film. He has elevated it to that point. And his work is absolutely genius.
After knocking on all those doors for so many years, it was Peter Guber who really kind of got it at least enough to move the project forward.
Oh, absolutely. My partner, Ben Melnicker, told me after we had gotten rejections from every studio that back in 1969 when he was at MGM, he wanted Peter Guber and two other gentlemen to run MGM production as a troika. And he said, you know, Guber is now partnered with Neil Bogart at Casablanca Records, and they're getting a cash infusion from PolyGram. They're going to be making movies. He's younger. He's more hip than all the guys we've been pitching to. He said, let me try to get Peter on the phone. He may get this. And I spoke to Peter, did a quick pitch on the phone. He said, get out here. And a couple of days later, we were out in L.A. and did the whole pitch in person, and he said, I totally get this. We will back this. Let's get started. And that's really the genesis for it at that point.
And, of course, even from that point, it still took years and years. And it really is the story of, as much as anything else, the persistence it takes to really see one's passion transferred to the screen in Hollywood.
Well, I'll tell you, Jeff, there are times during that 10-year human endurance contest that we went through where my back was against the wall. I didn't know where my next dollar was coming from. Everybody's telling me I'm terrible, my idea stinks, and I had to really test my mettle, look deep inside myself, and say, okay, am I just being stubborn here, or is the whole world wrong, and am I right, and do I really totally believe in myself and in my work? And it's a heck of a test, and for me, it was an incredible part of this whole journey.
Given how much collaboration is inherently involved in the process of making movies, were there times that you even worried about the ability to let go a little, to transfer some of that passion that had gone on since you were 5 years old to the hands of others that had to really be the ones to execute this vision?
I think what's essential in Hollywood and what separates out, for instance, the great comic book-based films from the not-so-great comic book-based films, you've got to find a filmmaker who understands a character and has a passion for a character and then has a vision for that character and knows how to execute that vision. And at that point, you've got to become the greatest cheerleader in the world and leave it in the hands of someone like a Christopher Nolan or a Tim Burton to do what needs to be done. And, you know, when people ask me now, well, what about next summer's The Dark Knight Rises, I simply say to them, well, you've seen what he has done with The Dark Knight and Batman Begins, so just fasten your seatbelt because you know he totally gets it.
One of the reasons that you wrote this memoir, you say, is because you really wanted kids to understand the whole arc of your journey because you felt that it was really motivational in so many ways.
I think it's really important. You know, Jeff, after Dark Knight opened and at that time became the second highest grossing film in history, my wife Nancy sat me down and she said, okay, now, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I thought about it and I said, well, what I'd really like to do now is talk to as many young people as possible, get my story out, let them know without any BS what I went through, how you can make your dreams come true. And it doesn't have to be anything glitzy and glamorous. You know, my dad made his dreams come true as a mason with bricks and stone. He loved what he did. Couldn't wait to get to work every morning, working 6 days a week his whole life. And you can achieve that. But it's not easy. And you have to be prepared, like young Bruce Wayne did, to make a commitment and potentially march through hell till you get to the other side. But it's doable. I did it, and thus anyone can do it. And that, I've been getting such a great response from my talks around North America. I've been able to inspire a lot of people, a lot of young people. And I knew then I had to write the book. I had to get my story down and get it out there and make them believe they can make their dreams come true, even in the tough world we live in today.
Michael Uslan, his memoir is The Boy Who Loved Batman, the true story of how a comic-obsessed kid conquered Hollywood to bring The Dark Knight to the silver screen. It's just out from Chronicle Books. Michael, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Jeff, this was terrific, and a lot of information on the book can be found at theboywholovedbatman.com.
Michael Uslan, thank you so much.